Matthew 5, verses 27 through 30. The 21st talk in a series on the Gospel of Matthew was presented by Ron Julian on June 12, 2016, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2016. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Technical difficulties resulted in reduced sound quality during a question.
It occurs to me, before I start my prepared remarks, I was just thinking that we're looking at a passage today where Jesus is going to tell us something about some of his perspective on sexual morality. And this is a day where, if the story in the news is right, a man who was religious went into a bar and killed a bunch of people because he considered them to be sexually immoral. It's the kind of thing that sort of puts you off wanting to make judgments about people's sexual behavior. I don't know that what I'm going to say is necessarily going to help sort that out. I think actually it does speak to it a little bit. At any rate, it sort of gives you the framework within which I think about such questions. But I know things can happen in the world that all of a sudden put a very different spin on the things we're talking about. So why don't we just take a second and pray before I start. Father, we are all either going to get what we deserve or we're going to receive mercy from you. We thank you that you have reached out in mercy. We ask that you would be merciful to us. We ask that you would be merciful to all of the people involved in the terrible events today. We just ask that you would help all of us and all of those involved to stand, to trust you, to stand firm in coming to love and follow your will for their lives. And we thank you that you have reached out to us, and we ask you to please not let us go. Amen. Okay, during his ministry in Galilee, Jesus gathered his disciples together in the presence of a large crowd, and he taught them. It's what we refer to as the Sermon on the Mount. So we're continuing on in that sermon, chapter 5 of Matthew. We'll be starting with verse 27. Matthew 5, 27, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into Gehenna. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you. For it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into Gehenna." So I'd like to start with some basic comments about what I think Jesus means here, and then we have a bunch of stuff that I want to talk about. So first of all, 5:27, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery,' but I say to you that everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Jesus here is quoting one of the Ten Commandments. Remember last week, we looked at another one of the Ten Commandments, "You shall not commit murder." This one is, "You shall not commit adultery." Let's remember, my assertion is that Jesus is explaining what he meant when he says, "Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven." Jesus is not critiquing or disagreeing with the Old Testament. Jesus is critiquing the way the Pharisees used the Old Testament to defend themselves as righteous people. And so I think he means something like this: "You have heard the Pharisees say," when they talk about what it takes to be a righteous person, "that the law forbids the act of adultery. And of course, since they themselves have never committed this act, they think that they must be good people." So I think something like that is at stake in what he's saying here. It's interesting to notice that Jesus is speaking from the perspective of the man involved here rather than the woman. This is not surprising, really. Jesus is addressing the self-concept of the Pharisees, and they were men. The Old Testament laws concerning adultery tended to address the initiative and responsibility of the man in such things. In a few verses, Jesus is going to talk about divorce, and divorce was something initiated by the man in this culture. So I think Jesus is speaking in this passage to the male self-righteousness that results from having never committed the act of adultery under the law. Jesus is also speaking into a culture where people are married. Might be worthwhile to point that out in our own culture. This was a cultural situation where it was expected that a man would marry, and typically a woman needed the cultural support and protection of a husband. So fundamentally, Jesus is talking to married men about how they relate to married women. For a man to commit adultery is to violate another marriage by sleeping with a wife that is not his. He adulterates the marriage. He brings impurity into the pure relationship between another man and wife. And of course, you're probably familiar with the fact that in cultures throughout the world, the impurity of adultery, the adulterating aspect of adultery, has a lot to do with the fact that the woman might get pregnant. Many cultures have double standards for men and women. It is never right for a wife to sleep with someone besides her husband because she might compromise the bloodline. But a man can sleep with harlots because he is not going to get pregnant. So that's a very common thing in the cultures throughout the world. So it is, of course, very significant that Jesus brings the issue back to the heart of the man. Everyone who looks at a woman with lust for her has already committed adultery with her in his heart. We're not talking about undesirable practical consequences. We're not talking about anyone getting pregnant. We're not talking about polluting the bloodline. We're not talking about any overt, socially undesirable action at all. We're talking about what is going on in the heart of the man, unknown to everyone but himself. I think it's important, it's really important from my perspective, to note then that Jesus is not saying anything new here. Sometimes he is portrayed, I've mentioned this before, sometimes he is portrayed as adding to or correcting the law. In this case, it's very common for us to have a kind of culturally imparted idea to us that the Ten Commandments only dealt with outward behavior. But Jesus is saying something much more important. He's coming along and adding the more important aspect of what is happening in the heart. But the fact is, as you probably know, Jesus is actually relying on the Ten Commandments here. The seventh commandment is, "You shall not commit adultery." But count three more, 8, 9, 10. The tenth commandment in Exodus 20:17 says, "You shall not lust after your neighbor's house. You shall not lust after your neighbor's wife, or his male servant, or his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor." So, from my perspective, and I think a lot of people would say the same thing, Jesus is not adding some new emphasis on the importance of the heart. The tenth commandment already emphasizes the importance of the heart. Not just what you do, but what you are thinking about what you do. We can remember in Romans 7 how Paul speaks about this commandment and its impact on himself. He says, "What shall we say then? Is the law sin? May it never be. On the contrary, I would not have come to know sin except through the law, for I would not have known about coveting if the law had not said, 'You shall not covet.' But sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, produced in me coveting of every kind, for apart from the law, sin is dead. And I was once alive apart from the law, but when the commandment came, sin became alive, and I died. And this commandment, which was to result in life, proved to result in death for me, for sin, taking opportunity through the commandment, deceived me, and through it killed me." There's a lot to talk about in that passage, and I'm not going to go into all of the ins and outs of that, but it is not an accident, I think, that Paul chose the 10th commandment as the law that he says made his own sin clear. I feel fairly confident that Paul, who was a devout Pharisee, had never committed the act of adultery. So the 7th commandment wouldn't have particularly troubled him. He kept that commandment fine. But it was the 10th commandment, the one that talked about where his mind and heart went, that made Paul realize the extent of his problem with sin. So my basic point here is this: Jesus is not adding to or correcting the Old Testament here. He is merely bringing out the implications of what was already there. Remember, Jesus said that he came to fulfill the law, that nothing would pass from the law until all was fulfilled. And here he is telling us that we must take the law much more seriously than the Pharisees did. So, what is the 10th commandment prohibiting then? If that's what's at stake here, and I think it is, then what's it about? We are not supposed to covet, to lust after our neighbor's house, for example. So I think that if we reflect on it a bit, we can easily see that it's not simple desire that we are talking about here. If my neighbor has a nice house, there is nothing evil about saying, "Wow, that is a nice house. It would be great to have a house like that." There's nothing necessarily wrong with looking at it with the sense that that is a desirable thing. But the fact is that God has ordained that my neighbor has that house and not me. What if I won't let go of that? What if I rebel against that in my mind? What if I refuse to live within the boundaries that God has given me? I don't act on those desires. I don't go over and kill my neighbor and steal his house, but I nurse that resentment in my mind. I lust after that house. I resent my neighbor for having what I do not. I resist submitting to God's right to order my life as he wills. I think this is the kind of thing that we were talking about when the 10th commandment forbids us to covet. It's not just the fact of desire, but it is that nursing of the grievance that I don't have that thing and my insistence that I will not be content before God until I do have it. This can be even more powerful when we talk about lusting after another man's wife, which the 10th commandment also forbids. Again, I think it seems clear to me at any rate that there is nothing essentially evil about sexual desire. God made us with sexual desire. We are sexual beings. We can't help noticing that another person is attractive. Our bodies can't help responding that a sexual relationship with that person could be nice. That's the way we are designed. But where do we go with that? Where do we go from there? To covet, to lust after, means to cling in my mind to that which God has forbidden me. That woman is not my wife, but I am going to nurse those feelings and desires that would only be appropriate if she were my wife. Now, we're all aware here that sexuality is a pretty powerful physical and mental phenomenon. Sexuality gives us a unique link between our minds and our bodies. Almost uniquely among human desires, sexual desire can give us a pretty strong counterfeit for the real thing if we nurse and inflame those desires. I don't have to get real graphic here. I think you get where I'm coming from, right? I mean, it's a little hard for me to live in my neighbor's house in a profoundly counterfeit way, but it's a lot easier for me to sleep with my neighbor's wife in my mind because of the relationship between our minds and bodies in sexuality. It's a place where self-control is definitely called for. Self-control, you remember, being one of the fruits of the Spirit. I may not be able to have sex with that woman in real life, but I can have sex with her in private, in my mind. It is that refusal to live within the will of God that is the evil, as I understand it. God has forbidden me to have a sexual relationship with that woman, and yet I pursue it in my mind anyway. That is what I understand the 10th commandment to mean when it forbids me to lust after my neighbor's wife. And I think Jesus means exactly the same thing. I don't think he means anything different than what the 10th commandment is talking about. When he speaks of looking on a woman to lust after her, that's what he's getting at. It is to commit in our hearts the adultery that God has forbidden us with the real person. And as I said, because sex is such a powerful phenomenon involving body and mind, we can go very far in having that imaginary sexual encounter anyway. So I'll have a little bit more to say about that in a few minutes, but let's keep going with 529. If your right eye makes you stumble, tear it out and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to be thrown into Gehenna. If your right hand makes you stumble, cut it off and throw it from you, for it is better for you to lose one of the parts of your body than for your whole body to go into Gehenna. The word stumble is an important one in the Bible. Literally, it's talking about tripping and falling, but most often in biblical usage, it's talking about falling away from God to one's destruction. Something that causes me to stumble is something that causes me to turn away from God and his mercy and salvation in some way. Either it's something that makes me no longer want to be involved with God, or something that is more interesting to me than God, or whatever that might be. That's the thing that causes me to stumble. We can see that Jesus clearly has something serious in mind here with this stumbling, because in the picture that he uses, the result of stumbling is having one's body thrown into Gehenna, the place of judgment and condemnation. Now, from my perspective, it's fairly easy to deal with what Jesus is saying here, except I think that we might, as some people have in the history of the church, make the mistake of thinking that Jesus is actually recommending self-mutilation as a way of solving the problem of sin. Let me sit down next to you. I'm your counselor here. You're having a little trouble with sin? I cut that thing off. That's what you got to do. I don't think that's what Jesus is meaning to get at, because the problem is I'm going to have to cut this off really to solve that problem, and that's going to be a little drastic. So let's think about the imagery he uses. This is how I understand what he's getting at. The last thing that I want to do is tear out my eye or cut off my hand. In this life now, where I am right now, they are precious to me. Why in the world would I do that? What could I possibly gain for cutting off my hand or tearing out my eye? I need them. I don't want to live without them. I've got to have them. But Jesus is saying, what if the choice were losing your hand or losing your whole body? In other words, losing everything. Your eye, your hand may seem precious to you, but is keeping your eye today worth losing everything forever tomorrow? I think that's the nature of the choice that Jesus is confronting us with. Not that he actually thinks that tearing out my eye is going to solve the problem, but I am going to be confronted in life with things that seem to me to be non-negotiable. They are precious. I have to keep them. I have to have them now. And I think that he's suggesting that when we come to this area of sexual gratification, that can be one of those places where it seems to us to be non-negotiable. I have to have it on my terms. But if those things cause me to stumble, if there are things that are drawing me away from putting my trust in God, then they are not precious, they're my enemy. What good will it do me to have what I want now if it leads to my destruction in the end? So Jesus is asking us to take very seriously the question of how even the choices we're making in our mind about how we handle our sexuality, to what extent are we actually willing to confront that and say, you know, the life that God has to offer means more to me. Okay, so I have a bunch of stuff I want to say here. At the end of the talk last week, Toby and I had a discussion. It's always fun to have a discussion with Toby. Part of that discussion centered on the word moral. He and I seemed to be using the word in different senses. As it happens, I think that the distinctions that he and I were trying to sort out as we were talking about the word moral are very relevant to the passage today. In today's passage, Jesus is teaching us about sexual thoughts and behavior, and it is typical for us to use the word moral a lot, especially when talking about that sort of thing. We talk about moral and immoral behavior, morality and immorality, and usually the first thing that comes to mind when we use those words is sexual behavior and sexual, our thoughts and conduct. So it seems relevant to me, the kind of distinction that we were trying to sort out last week as we were talking seems relevant to me in trying to think about what Jesus has said here. By the way, I'm not speaking to Toby or for Toby. He and I had a good talk afterwards. I think we had a meeting of the minds about things, and I don't feel any need to say more about his comments. That's not why I'm saying this. I'm also not claiming that he would agree with what I'm saying here. I have no idea. I think he might, but I'm not going to speak for him. But again, the distinction, the thing that we were kicking around seems to me to be relevant to this. So I decided that I would give a long thought out answer to the issue that came up last time, because I think it's very relevant to what we're looking at here. It is my strong belief that we as human beings all face one fundamental choice. And there are different ways that we could describe what that choice is. The way I have chosen to describe it here is our choice is, will we live in truth? I have borrowed this language from Kierkegaard. I've been reading Kierkegaard lately, and I thought this is a nice way of putting it, so I'm going to steal it from him. This choice is fundamental because by nature, we do not want to live in truth. The truth is hard and requires hard things of us. The truth is, for example, that God is our creator and is good and merciful and trustworthy. The truth is that my neighbor is a fellow creature of God and just as important as I am. The truth is that my life is filled with evil, and we could go on and on. The truth requires me to trust God, change my way of thinking, change my way of living. Living in truth is not just about knowing true facts. Living in truth means wanting the truth to be true, if you understand what I mean. A willingness for the chips to fall where they may. To my mind, being a person of faith and being a person who wants to live in truth are just two ways of describing the same thing. That is, the person of faith is willing to turn away from lies and turn toward truth. That is why that person believes the hard truth of the gospel, for example. This fundamental choice, this decision whether or not to live in truth, is a profoundly moral decision. That is, it is a decision about right and wrong. It is right to live in the truth about God, my neighbor, and myself. It is wrong to live a lie. And we learn this from the Bible. This is not something that I'm making up, I don't think. The whole story of the Bible shows us how significant it is to God, how the destiny of peoples is hanging on whether they are people who are willing to live in the truth or not. So this decision whether to live in truth, it is a decision of profound rightness and wrongness. So it is the most profoundly moral decision we will make. Now, the decision to live in truth has implications for how we live our lives. Sometimes those implications can be generalized as commands or principles. Last week we saw Jesus talking about another of the Ten Commandments, you shall not commit murder. Abstaining from murder follows from being a person who wants to live in the truth. There are at least two truths at stake here. First, God is creator, and he alone has the right to give and take life. I'm submitting to that truth. And secondly, it is true that my neighbor is as equally important to God as I am myself. I am to treat my neighbor as I would wish to be treated because the truth is that we are equals. We have equal dignity and importance in the eyes of God. So the law against murder can be seen as an outward description of the kind of choice a person who lives in the truth would want to make. We are willing to see God as He is. We are willing to see our neighbors as they are. We are willing to see ourselves as we are. And so we recognize that to murder our neighbor is to choose against the truth, to rebel against God. We do recognize, however, that there are many reasons why a person might choose to keep this law against committing murder. There are many people who do not fundamentally live in the truth who nevertheless are not murderers. Maybe the civil penalties are an incentive not to murder. Nobody wants to be stoned to death or die in the electric chair. Maybe they don't murder because it is satisfying to feel like a law-abiding, godly citizen. Maybe murder is just too much trouble to hassle with. Or maybe there are just people made in the image of God who recognize that murder is evil and who would rather live in a world without murder if they can. We can see then that regarding murder, there are different sorts of people. There are murderers who are murderers because they do not want to live in truth. There are those who have never murdered, but still, we can say of them, they do not want to live in truth. They are not children of God. They are not believers. There are those who have never murdered who do want to live in the truth. And let us not forget the example of King David. David was a murderer who nevertheless ultimately wanted to live in truth. So I hope my point is clear. There is a great difference between doing the right behavior and living in the truth. Okay, now let me bring the word moral back into the discussion. Remember, I'm saying that there is this difference between doing the right behavior and living in the truth. But the fact is that I could legitimately use the word moral to describe either one of those different things. I could say there is a great difference between being a moral person and living in the truth. The word moral here is being used to describe people who keep their behavior within the accepted moral boundaries. They do what is expected of them according to the law or the religious customs or whatever. When I was younger, there was a political discussion about the moral majority. The moral majority were those who chose to live their lives within the accepted American moral boundaries. It is wrong to have sex outside of marriage, so they didn't have sex outside of marriage. At least that was the theory. It is wrong to break the law, so they didn't break the law. But we could legitimately ask the question, how many of the moral majority were in fact living in truth? That is, how many of the moral majority were genuine believers, children of God? I'm not answering that question, I'm just asking it, but I feel pretty confident that there were many upstanding moral Americans who would call themselves the moral majority whose hearts were not committed to living in truth before God. So, again, we could use the language in that way to say there is a great difference between being a moral person and living in the truth. But I think we could go the other way. We could use the word moral in a different way. We could say there is a great difference between doing the right behavior and being a moral person. In other words, being a truly moral person means wanting to do the right thing, and the right thing is to live in the truth. The truly moral person is the one who has rightly turned to God. Because this question, will I live in the truth, as I'm presenting it, is the ultimate moral right or wrong sort of question. It is profoundly right to live in the truth. It is profoundly wrong to live a lie. This is what God has told us from the beginning. This is, in one sense, it captures everything that God is saying to us in the Bible, in one sense. It is a profoundly moral issue whether I want to live in the truth or not. Now, in the context of Jesus' teaching in this passage, I think part of the problem that Toby and I were having in communicating is that I tend to use the word moral in this second way, in this context, because I see that as kind of being the flavor of what Jesus is saying here. He says, your righteousness must surpass that of the scribes and the Pharisees. And one way to describe that would be, you have to be more moral than the Pharisees. You must have the true morality. That is, you are not to justify yourselves by appealing to various laws you have kept. Rather, you are to be people who want to live in the truth. You are to be people who are willing to accept the implications of the truth for how you treat people, how you live as a sexual person, how you are honest about your own moral failings, and so on. So, because this section does not just concentrate on what we might call faith directly, Jesus doesn't say, it is not enough to refrain from murdering people, you also have to be people with a genuine faith, or you must also genuinely want to live in the truth. But that, in essence, I'm saying, is what he's getting at. Instead, though, he talks about the sorts of people we should be in our moral behavior. He's saying that you think because you haven't murdered anyone, that makes you a good person. But God is asking you to submit to a hard truth. God is calling you to a deep commitment to the well-being of your neighbor. Your neighbor is just as important as you are. You are to seek to live in that truth. You are to be honest before God about your failure to live in that truth. Living in the truth means you will not self-righteously congratulate yourself for being moral, but you will pursue the true morality, the willingness to live in the truth about God, yourself, and your neighbor. So, Jesus' message is, don't be moral, be moral. Okay, now, so glad I cleared that up for you. Now, let's come back to the topic of sexuality. In our culture, everyone knows that Christianity has something to say about sexuality. I am aware of two strong voices that I have heard in my culture throughout my life. On the one hand, I keep hearing voices that say, Christians are too hung up on sex. They're always worried about how other people conduct themselves sexually. They're so judgmental. Why don't they talk as much about greed or racism or something like that? On the other hand, I keep hearing voices that say, our culture is morally depraved. We have abandoned God's will concerning sexuality. This brings great suffering socially and psychologically, and it is spiritually destructive. Ultimately, it means we have turned away from God. So I've got these two voices, one on each side. How do I process what those voices have been saying throughout my life? Well, I think that Jesus' teaching here helps us, a little bit at any rate, to know how to respond to both of those voices. The first part of his warning is against the self-righteousness of the Pharisees. They rightly understand that God has forbidden adultery, but somehow they have come to think that the presence or absence of this outward behavior is the true mark of the good person. Who is going to inherit the kingdom of God? Might not put it this way directly, but basically those who, like me, have refrained from committing adultery. That's who's going to inherit the kingdom of God. So I think Jesus is charging them with being moral people in a sense, but they are not people who want to live in the truth. And it is in fact true that there are Christians who are like these Pharisees. I'm not going to say who they are. I know there are some. My sincere and constant prayer is that I am not one of them. They point out the moral depravity of our culture, and they have a point. They're right. They point out the destructive nature of sexual immorality, and they're right about that. But there is this self-righteous vibe that they give off that gives the impression that they wish everyone else were as righteous as they are. They are not really confronting their own evil, the places where they need to repent. They are moral people, but they are not people who want to live in the truth. And sometimes I think our culture rightly picks up that there is this whiff of hypocrisy in what they're hearing on this topic. But the second part of Jesus' warning does not release us from thinking about how we approach our sexuality. He calls us to confront those attitudes all the more. Jesus does not say, "You Pharisees are too preoccupied with sex. You need to lighten up." Instead, he paints a picture of how we must be sexual persons and people who want to live in truth. The real moral issue in sex is not sex. The real moral issue in sex is how we relate to God. And so those voices among us who point out that our culture is sexually lost are profoundly right. Our culture has almost totally lost the language to even talk about how sex is a creation of God and what his purpose for it might be. Our culture has lost sight of the fundamental choice of every person, which is whether we will live in truth before God. And so it is true, we have ceased to learn from God what he made sex to be and the role he intended it to play in our lives. So, are Christians too hung up on sex? Well, what is our message to the world? Are we implicitly saying, you need to clean up your sexual behavior and be good like me? If so, then we are just like the Pharisees, and the world has the right to say to us, no, our righteousness needs to exceed yours. And yeah, then our focus on sex becomes a kind of distraction. But what if our message to the world is, you and I face one fundamental choice. Will we live in truth or not? Will we seek to know the truth about God and ourselves and our neighbor or not? If we want to live in truth, then our God has something to say to us about our sexuality. He created it. It is a powerful force. And so it is one of those places where we must confront the question, am I willing to know the truth and live in it or not? If sexual gratification on my own terms is so important to me that I turn from God and live a lie, then I am lost. I don't think there's any way of getting around it. That's what Jesus is saying here. We're talking about the whole body dumped in Gehenna if I will not turn away from that which takes me from God. That's the kind of truth that we have to confront. That's true for me and you and for everyone who has ever lived. And we cannot say less than that to the world. Now, I suppose I should make the obvious qualification that external behavior is not nothing. I know we're emphasizing that internal person, but you and I live with the day-to-day consequences of our own behavioral choices and everyone else's choices. We can't help wanting to live in a world where people make good choices, even if they're hypocritical. Do I want my kid to walk to school through a neighborhood where everyone would just as soon kill him as look at him? Or would I like him to walk to school through a neighborhood of hypocrites with a cultural rejection of murder? Wouldn't I want my daughter to go to a school where all the boys have been enculturated to believe that sex is a matter of respect and love between two committed people, even if inside they are hypocrites? From a pragmatic perspective, the righteousness of the Pharisees has its advantages. There are a lot of people that I would rather not have as my neighbor. I would put the Pharisee relatively high on the list of people that I would like to live next to. But exactly because external righteousness is so attractive in the here and now, that is why it can become a powerful distraction. Who doesn't want to live in a world that is safer, more peaceful, free from the consequences of bad choices? And so we can get the idea that the job of Christianity is to morally transform the world so that we can live easier lives. Sometimes the most moral people are the most worldly ones, with a focus on making the world a morally safe place to live today. Now, I am not against trying to morally transform the world. That's not a bad idea. That's a good job for some people to take on. I'm not knocking it. But the fact is that the job that we all have is to morally transform ourselves. And by that I mean our job is to continually make the moral choice to seek to live in the truth, and then to face the implications of that for how we live. Okay, so here we are, Christians who want to live in the truth, but who also face powerful sexual desires that we have trouble controlling. We hear what Jesus is saying about committing adultery in your heart, and we tremble because we recognize that there's a real thing that he's talking about there. So where has Jesus left us? What does he want us to take away from what he's saying? Well, probably a lot of things. I have a couple that make sense to me that I think are what he wants us to take away from this. First of all, I think Jesus is calling us to think deeply about the principles involved in the 10th commandment. We are to take seriously the commandment against coveting, against lusting after what God has forbidden us to have. Notice that this is a commandment that is clearly not about external consequences in the world. Real adultery hurts other people. Murder hurts other people. Robbery hurts other people. But lusting in our hearts is an offense against God. It is a refusal to live in truth. It is our refusal to accept God's right to put boundaries on our lives. Jesus wants us to see that morality is not just about bad consequences. If we refrain from committing adultery, that's good. Promises have not been broken. People have not gotten hurt. But the fundamental issue for me personally is whether I accept God's right to put his wise boundaries on my life. Have I bowed the knee to God inside where it counts? That's one of the things that Jesus is asking us to think about. But if we are people who are seeking to live in truth, then we also have to admit that we are not what we ought to be inside. After all, that's what happened to Paul when he reflected on the 10th commandment. Remember that it was that commandment against coveting that broke Paul. It was the 10th commandment that showed Paul his own sin. When he says that thing that we all identify with so much, the very thing that I don't want to do, I do, and the thing that I do want to do, I don't do, that was all tied up with lessons that he learned from the commandment against lusting after something that God has forbidden you. So I think that this too is what Jesus wants us to do here. I have more to say about that in a minute, but I think that is part of what he wants us to do. We are not pretending we are good people because we have not committed the outward act of adultery. We acknowledge that God has a right to our very hearts and desires, and we admit that our hearts are not what they should be. Admitting our sin and seeking God's mercy is a crucial part of living in the truth. And what Jesus says here about adultery in our hearts highlights that particular truth, the power of sin in the lives of human beings, perhaps more than any other part of the Sermon on the Mount. That particular thing we all know has gotten the imagination of people. It has captured people's attention. Yeah, if you're going to start talking about what I'm doing in my head, now we're talking about some serious stuff here. But I have been arguing in this section that Jesus' purpose goes beyond just showing us our sin, and I think that is true also. He doesn't merely want us to say, oh, I can't do it, I need the forgiveness that Jesus brought on the cross. He does want that, but this particular section of the Sermon on the Mount, as I've been saying, is often taught as if that was the whole point, as if the whole point was to say, being a good person is so incredibly impossible that you'll never get there, so you need to be forgiven. I'm not saying that isn't a part of it, and this one, more than any other part, does emphasize to us how serious a thing it is to talk about being a righteous person before God. So yes, a significant part of living in the truth in relationship to what Jesus says here is a willingness to acknowledge I am not what I ought to be. I couldn't even pretend to be okay just because I have never committed adultery. I know perfectly well that I am not what I ought to be. But I think Jesus does also mean to show us the way that we must go. It is also meant to be a positive exhortation to what we should be pursuing in life. God wants our hearts, and we must strive to give them to him. Yes, we will often fail, but sometimes we won't. We are to live gratefully in the truth. God is merciful, and that is fantastic because I need his mercy every day. But the fact is, right now, the choice is before me. I am here, I am in this moment, and I face the question, shall I live in the truth or not? Shall I seek after God or not? It's not enough to just say, I can't do it, I need mercy, because I still must make the choice, am I going to live in the truth or not? What we must not do is tell ourselves that we are hot stuff because we have never murdered anyone or committed adultery with anyone. But on the other hand, we can't tell ourselves, hey, I'm forgiven, so it doesn't really matter what I do. We are called to seek to live in the truth, to be willing for God to show us what is true and to act on that. God is good and calls us to follow him in goodness, and God is merciful and forgives us for our many failures. To accept and live in both of those truths, I am called to follow God in his goodness. I am grateful for God's mercy in my failures. To accept both of those truths is the purpose of our lives. Okay, so that's what I was thinking about. So what are you thinking about?
I've just read two books.
Two books?
Rhetorical Group, both written by pastors/theologians, one who has a gay son. The first book is about the issue of what the Bible says about homosexuality, and the other one is the life this pastor and his son led as they tried to maintain their relationship. It is both very challenging, very challenging. And so you have this traditional cultural moral outrage at something as obvious as homosexuality, which both pastors use the example of greed and unnecessary wealth as one that's talked about more, and we don't have the outrage. But it seems to me it would be easier to break the habit of greed and living a wealthy life, at least according to this book, than it would be to give up being committed to that expression of sexuality. So here, if we could have across the board a bunch of people struggling with these issues, actually struggling with these issues, it seems to me that one of them is just stuck. How much they struggle. I could change my mind on that. So the stumbling.
If a person says, well, this is pastoral, this is a question, this would be a pastoral question. A person says, I just can't quit X, but I will continue to struggle in the rest of my life to honor God. Can we accept that as sincere in ourselves? I'm not worried about someone saying it to me. I'm worried about me saying it to someone else. Or is it the attitude of God has no right to tell me how to be? God has no right to put limits on me? Because most of the time, that's what I hear.
Right.
Goodness is good in, as far as it goes, but it's not like I have to respond obediently to something I want to do by not doing it. And so that I'm curious about, when do you plead with someone for their life and when do you walk with someone in their struggle? Kind of a, I'm sure you've faced this.
I've faced it personally.
With yourself and others, yeah. Yes. So just kind of tease that out a little bit, maybe.
Yeah, well, I think the distinction that you're making is a real one, but I don't know how to necessarily say this is how you tell what's going on. Notice that the focus of the passage that I've talked about today is on myself. That is, I'm listening to Jesus saying, he's saying, I should not think my righteousness needs to be greater than that of the Pharisees. So I have to not settle for, oh, I'm okay, I haven't done any of that stuff, but I have to actually come to the level of my heart and think about, am I willing to live in the truth and where am I going to go? Okay. When it comes to questions regarding sexuality, it gets complicated. Just to be clear what we're talking about, I don't believe that the Bible, that God has made a promise that whatever combination of things that have warped a person's sexual responses, that they respond in a way that is not the way we were designed to respond to things. I don't know that I have any promise that becoming a believer or becoming an obedient believer is necessarily going to change that overnight or even change it in my lifetime. So if what I mean is I can't change, meaning whenever I'm in the arena struggling with those sorts of issues, that's the kind of struggling that I'm doing, okay, I have no problem at all with saying that a genuine believer could be in that spot, and I'm sure many have been. Now, if what we mean is I can't quit, is I can't stop going to gay bars and having anonymous sex with other men, I'm willing to be persuaded that such a thing could be the case, but I don't, that's a very different thing. What we're saying is when you say I can't stop is I don't want to stop. You have to start with at least the I want to stop. I acknowledge God is right about this. This is the way I am doing this is not the way it should be done. So now that's the truth that I have to live in. Now, what am I going to do with that? There may be many failures along the way, but if I am open to what God is saying about these things, then I see them as failures. I shouldn't have been there. I shouldn't have done that. I've got to walk away from that. And the struggle to walk away from that is not saying I can't stop. It's saying I must stop, but I keep messing up. And I think I can't know. I think it's hard to say about ourselves in our struggles what those sorts of things mean. So is that person kidding themselves? Are they self-deceived? Is it that fundamentally they really don't want to give it up and they don't want to let God tell them how they ought to live? Or is it genuinely true that they do, but they have a lot of issues to sort through before that becomes an easy thing to do? That's where I wouldn't know how to begin to answer that. But I think those are the kinds of things that we think about. And for me, it always comes back to whenever I get confused in all of this stuff, I back up to myself. I think about where I am in the midst of this struggle and journey of life, that there are so many stories and so many people and so many struggles, and it's easy to get confused or overwhelmed by all of that stuff. And how can we even sort this out? And are we even right to raise these kinds of issues at all? And it gets very confusing. So to me, the way that I try to find my bearings is to come back to, what do I think that the Bible is saying? And am I going to deal with it? And now I can say, okay, yeah, I really do think that's what it's saying, and I'm going to have to deal with that. So I don't have a window into your heart, but I do know that fundamentally you're in the same situation. This is what the Bible's saying to you, and you're going to have to deal with it too. And if I can come back and think about it that way, then I can think justly, I think, about where other people are, and perhaps speak to them in a way that we can be both sympathetic and encouraging. I don't know. But I just, like I say, whenever I get overwhelmed by the bigness of those questions, I come back to the one guy that I know reasonably well, which is me. And then that's not a pretty picture, but at least I have something to work with. Anything else? Okay. Well, thanks for coming. We'll do this again next week, probably.